Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Trib hockey writers Jason Mackey and Jonathan Bombouli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Want to go, pretty boy? Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're going to play some friggin' old-time hockey!
New era of the Pens Roundtable with Bombouli and Mackey ready to go. Less than a week from the opener of the Penguins season, next Thursday in Dallas, 8:30 p.m. And joining us live on the phone from PNC Arena in Raleigh is Jason Mackey, Penguins beat reporter for Trib Total Media, and Jonathan Bombouli in studio, back from Johnstown. Jonathan, hello, welcome. Welcome back. Good to have you on here.
Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
You got it. It's your show.
It's my show, so thanks for having me on my show.
And Jason's live from Raleigh. How you doing, Jay? How's you avoiding the hurricane festivities yet?
So far, trying to stay dry, Kenny. It is not pretty down here. But the barbecue is still good. PNC is still a wonderful place to cover a game, so can't complain.
Good. Hope you get out of there before the real hurricane comes and the Penguins and the on-ice Hurricanes get this one in coming up tonight. Much to talk about, guys. Jason, I guess just give us a sense of what tonight's game will be like from a lineup point of view and how many decisions are still left to be made roster-wise that could be on the line tonight.
Well, to start with your last question, Kenny, a lot of decisions are still to be made. It's a funky-looking roster right now. Your top two lines are set, but Daniel Sprong has forced their hand to the point where they can't not play him. And so he skated on the line this morning with Nick Bonino and Pascal Dupuis, and I think that'll be an interesting one to watch. And that puts, keep in mind, Bo Bennett's out of the lineup. Bobby Farnham's going to come back tonight, and you've got David Perron skating on the fourth line. So at that point, that tells me you've got one forward too many. You have one miscast. You may have two forwards too many. And they broke up their top defense pairing, too. With Ole Mata playing with Rob Scuderi basically on the second pair, and then Letang and Cole on the top pair. All of that sort of boiled down to me tells me this is a team that still has a lot of questions to answer. And they're not necessarily problems, but they need to decide which direction they want to go. I think they want to see some guys playing with different guys, and that hasn't gone well this preseason. So it'll be interesting to see whether they're able to adjust tonight.
What's the decision, Jonathan, that intrigues you the most? Are you in agreement it's the Daniel Sprong, or at least that's one of the big ones that they've got to choose here?
Yeah, the Sprong one is definitely, it's just a fascinating thing because you know the kid has talent, but you don't expect him to be as far along as he is in terms of playing an NHL game. So when you see that in an unexpected way in camp, I mean, it can't help but catch your attention. I'm also interested in that. You mentioned Bobby Farnham being back in the lineup tonight, and you talk about some of the guys at the bottom of that lineup. If the fourth line were to have David Perron and Bo Bennett on it with, say, Matt Cullen, that would technically be the fourth line. I mean, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, it would be fourth. But that wouldn't play like a fourth line at all. And that would signal a real shift as far as trying to have a 12-man, four-line sort of offensive approach where you just roll through the lines, which is a lot like what Chicago and Tampa did getting to the finals last year. And you know, I mean, it's a copycat league like every other league. So to me, a scoring line on the fourth line like that, that would be really fascinating, whether Sprong's a part of it or not. That's something I would definitely keep an eye on.
And you got to think about that, Jason.
The biggest departure they can go from that is to insert Bobby Farnham into the lineup. I mean, he's going to agitate and provide theatrics, but he's not going to provide a physical punch to the point where they're going to rival, you know, the Capitals or the Blue Jackets or some of these heavier teams in their own division. So they basically are that team.
Yeah.
It's just how much do you want to commit to it?
Well, who is Daniel Sprong? If some people are just unaware of this guy and his story in the draft this offseason, who is he? And now we're talking third line with him, not fourth line, if he makes the team, right, Jay?
Yeah, third line. But I'll let JB describe who he is.
Yeah, I talked to him at the draft. He's an interesting kid because he's Dutch. And there have been, I don't know, maybe one or two Dutch players, in the history of the NHL. So that's odd. But what he did was his dad was a player of some renown in the Netherlands, and when he was seven, the family moved to Montreal specifically so the kid could play hockey. I mean, that was the whole impetus for the move, which is, you know, interesting in and of itself. He actually played in Wilkes-Barre before his junior career. There was a team in Wilkes-Barre with a wealthy owner who was loading up with European players to go win a Tier 1 National Junior Championship, which again is like a weird story. So he had a couple of Russians and a Dutch kid, and he brought them all over to Wilkes-Barre, and they did really well. So and I'd heard about him at the time. Like, you got to see this kid. He stick handles like nobody else, and he was, you know, 15 at the time or something like that. So then he went to the Quebec Junior League and scored a ton of goals in Charlottetown, and you know, I mean, was a legit first round, you know, sort of prospect. But then he didn't go in the first round. He went in the second round, and the knock on him was that didn't play a team game, kind of a floater, you know, would just like hang around at the blue line and try to get some offense going. Sort of, yeah, the young Mario style of play. And that he also wasn't a great teammate, like that he would criticize his teammates if they didn't get him the puck the way he wanted. So, obviously, that's a problem that will take care of itself when you're an 18-year-old playing with superstars. I mean, that wouldn't fly, obviously, in an NHL setting. But the stuff about him, you know, sort of not worrying about defense and being a floater, that's taken care of itself, too. Like, he did some of that in the London Rookie Tournament because he was the most skilled guy out there. But as he's sort of assimilated into an NHL environment, I think he's realized that he can't play like that. So they haven't seen any of that sort of, you know, those deficiencies. All you've seen is he's an amazing skater, a really good stick handler, and he has a tremendous shot. So, you know, a nine-game tryout is just the easiest decision in the world. I mean, of course you give him 9 games. He was that good in training camp. The hard decision comes, you know, in about a month when you have to decide, all right, do you burn a year of this kid's contract at age 18, or do you send him back to juniors and use that year when he's 21 or 22, when he's, you know, going to be a better player by then?
If he produces the way he's been, I honestly get what you're saying, JB, but I don't think it's going to be that hard of a decision. If you look objectively at what 12 forwards give this team the best chance to win, right now Daniel Sprong is one of them.
Well,
and that
certainly
could change. He could hit a wall, but right now he is one of them. And so you have to pay the guys who are going to give you a chance to win.
Yeah, and certainly if they use that four-line approach that I was talking about. If they're not trying to construct a fourth, third or fourth line that's a checking line or an energy line, if they just want four lines that can score, there's no question Sprong is one of your 11 best offensive or 12 best offensive forwards.
Now, we haven't seen Nick Bonino much. He had the late start to it, Jason, but what has he been like to see, and does he have chemistry with Sprong and Dupuy? Does that look like a good third line if that's the way it is for at least the first 9 games?
Well, I'm intrigued by it, I'll say that much. He and Dupuy looked together. It was one of the few bright spots of the game in Quebec. Those two played together, and I think that's kind of overblown, the fact that Bonino missed, you know, roughly a week with an illness. I'm not that concerned about it. I'm really not. He's a versatile player, can do a couple different things on the ice. He will see power play in shorthanded time. Maybe when Eric Ferrer gets back, he shifts to the wing. That's still kind of TBD, but he doesn't worry me at all. You can put Nick Bonino in pen right now as a third-line guy who's going to produce, who's going to be in the lineup. I like Bonino and Dupuy with Bennett. If that's the direction they go, let's say Daniel Sprong does hit a wall, I'd like David Perron on that line as well. I think Nick Bonino adds a lot. So I've seen nothing from him that has been the least bit concerning.
Not to mention they got, you know, the big trade, the Sutter trade in the offseason, but it sounds like Clendenning, who was one of the last parts of that trade, has turned into a pretty nice throw-in, if that was what it was, JB. And he might make this team as one of their top six defensemen, right?
Look, if you take out, I was thinking about this the other day, if you take everything out of the equation except what you've seen with your own eyes in exhibition games, if you take out contracts, if you take out, you know, managing egos, if you take the names off the back of the jerseys, who would the six best defensemen be to start the season? And Adam Clendenning would no doubt in my mind be one of them. He is, you know, and here's the thing. He's outplayed Derek Pouliot in preseason games. I mean, that's a fact. That's not really a point of contention. The interesting thing is that Clendenning is actually this guy isn't a guy who fought the hard way to get somewhere. He's not a lunch pail guy. He's a blue chipper. And he was a high draft pick. He was a guy who, in the AHL for 2 years, before last year he kind of had a spotty year. He was all over the place and with a number of different teams. But before that, he was like, you know, if not the best offensive defenseman prospect in the AHL, then certainly in the top three. So, you know, he got to a point where he had to clear waivers, and Chicago and Vancouver kind of, you know, didn't really see how they could fit him in. And so that made him expendable. But the kid is, and you wonder, because he's not that big. He's maybe 6 foot. But he plays Mike Johnston's the way Mike Johnston wants his defenseman to play. I mean, he's mobile. He moves the puck well. He doesn't get bogged down in the neutral zone. If you're going to ask him to, you know, muscle up on Nick Foligno or you know, one of the, you know, Brandon Saad or some of those more powerful Columbus forwards or something like that, he might struggle. But in terms of transition game, retrieve the puck, get it out of the zone, he's looked really good. I have a hard time keeping him out of the top six. If I'm drawing up a lineup for, you know, opening night in Dallas, Adam Clendenning's in it if I'm making that list.
If that's the case, Jason, in this Pens Roundtable here on Trib Live Radio, Ken Laird, Jonathan Bomboli, and Jason Mackey live in Raleigh. I mean, Rutherford's been criticized for some of his trades, probably the Dupre trade more than any, but this Sutter trade, to get Bonino, to get Clendenning, and to get a higher pick, it seems like a total steal here, as we said on October 2.
Yeah. I mean, kudos to Rutherford. Basically, you can look at Jim Rutherford's track record and criticize the Simon Dupre trade. What else can you criticize? Are you going to criticize getting Phil Kessel? I don't think you would do that.
Sure, not Patrick much.
Patrick Hornquist, same way. I think he fits perfectly. Bringing over Sergei Plotnikov, fine with that. Signing Eric Fehr. I think some of the free agent signings last season were questionable and did not work. I think that was, you know, but as far as trades and bringing in guys, I think he's done an exceptional job. And I, for the life of me, I can't figure out what Vancouver is doing, signing Sutter to the extension that it signed Sutter to, and trading for him, giving up Nick Bonino on a 1.9 cap hit, and then throwing in Clendenning, who JB talked about, and I mean, it's every bit accurate. Like, what are you doing? I just can't make sense of that. I'd do that deal every time, and I don't know. Looking at this roster, knowing Rutherford, knowing what this roster needs, I would not be surprised to see something flipped. You know, whether it's Perron, Bennett, take one of these assets and address the defense. I do think there are some holes defensively. I think they could benefit from having one more and one more in a top four role, or somebody who could play a top four role. So I would not be surprised that maybe the first 3 weeks of the season, as teams kind of, and I wrote about this on Chipped Ice yesterday, but as teams kind of sort out what they have, what they need, what they're shopping for, I would not be surprised to see that happen at all, where they take one of these guys, maybe they're productive, and they turn him into a defenseman.
Well, let's talk David Perron then, and possibilities of trades here, Jonathan. And, you know, Perron was a Rutherford trade for a first-round pick, so maybe that's one that people would squawk about, although, you know, they needed help at the time, and they went aggressively after it. But why is he on a fourth line tonight, and what is the message that Mike Johnston is sending by putting him on a fourth line tonight?
Well, I mean, I think part of the message might be that he wants four lines that can score, like I said before. But I think another part of it is, I mean, Perron did get a shot for a couple of, well, like a period and a half with Crosby and Kessel. And then Dupuis took his place, and he took, you know, about a period and a half. The bottom line to me is that, I know this is maybe controversial, because I know people watched Chris Kunitz all year last year and found him to be lacking, and I understand that. But to me, the message of David Perron being on the fourth line is Chris Kunitz won that job with Kessel and Crosby. And, you know, if you're not in that spot, you're either going to be on the third line or the fourth line. And you know, I don't think it makes a whole lot of a difference which one it is. But to me, Kunitz has been the right guy for that combination, because they need somebody who's, you know, sort of sturdy and dependable, and that's what Kunitz is at this point in his career. So, you know, he's not going to be a 35 goal scorer ever again. I understand that. I think he understands that. But to have a guy who can sort of, you know, be counted on while Crosby and Kessel do their thing offensively, I don't criticize that move. I don't see any holes in it. I think it's the exact right move. And so if you're committed to Kunitz with Crosby and Plotnikov with Malkin, then everybody else has to sort of jockey for positions in the bottom six, and that's just life. I mean, that's not, it's not necessarily a slap in the face. It's just, unless you consider a slap in the face, you didn't beat out Chris Kunitz for that one particular position that was open.
And I also think we can pump the brakes on, you know, the David Perron's on the fourth line. It's not, it's not permanent. Sergei Plotnikov has played, what, three or four North American games. Like, it might change. What we've seen might not be how he's going to play the entire season. So if he struggles, you know, you throw David Perron in there. He can also go on the third line. I don't think there's any issue with that. And he could, you know, Chris Kunitz could drop off. It's still, you know, I hate this cliche. We're going to hear it 9 million times between now and December, but it's still early, and things will change. Like JB said, a large part of the Kunitz sample size last year, no, he didn't play well enough to merit top-line minutes, but the roster was not such that they could replace him. It is now. So if he doesn't play up the snuff or he's not giving that line something, then, yeah, you can throw David Perron on there. Johnston even talked about throwing Bo Bennett on there. I think that, you know, kind of the takeaway here is that there are a lot of options where last year there weren't options.
Was Kunitz legitimately hurt last year, Jason? I mean, was that a no-doubter, no question about it? He wasn't himself?
Yeah, he had a bum wheel for a large part of the year and also had trouble. And, you know, a lot was talked about with that iron deficiency, but there was some reality as far as how he was able to recover and how he was able to work out and skate. And it just, I think the best way to put it, Kenny, is that he wasn't himself. And I think Chris Kunitz looks more like himself and more like the Chris Kunitz Penguins fans have seen in the past this year.
Well, if that's the case, and I wonder, Jonathan, how convinced they are that that'll keep up all season, because the guy's not a young pup anymore, right? He's 36, so he might start the year and look good on that line. But if you're Rutherford, are you confident enough that you're going to trade Perron thinking that Kunitz is my guy for the whole season, or do you have to keep Perron to keep that fire lit and keep the rotation going?
Well, that's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought of it that way. I mean, and Dupuy also plays into that because, I mean, he's a guy who's, you know, in his mid-30s and is coming off the blood clot situation, you know, is going to be on and off blood thinners throughout the course of the season. So when Kunitz and Dupuy are healthy, you say to yourself, well, look at this surplus of wingers, and then all of a sudden they start to be, you know, 35 or they get injured or they, you know, have to take time off to handle the blood thinner situation, and then pretty soon you're calling up Connor Sheary to be in your top six, which, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world, but it's not an ideal situation. So I think that is a good point. I think that would be, that would definitely give Rutherford pause, as, you know, if he is looking at a Perron trade or a Bennett trade to improve that defense. You're right. Because, I mean, depth is a big part of this. It's a big part of it on defense, too. Like, Mata and Letang look incredible in the preseason. I mean, Mata especially just has been, you know, pretty much flawless. And the temptation would probably be to play those guys, man, ride that horse as long as you can. Play them like, Seabrook.
Ride it till the wheels fall off.
I was going to say Keith and Seabrook. Yeah, right. Ride them till the wheels fall off. Play them like Keith and Seabrook in Chicago. Play them 35 minutes a game. But if you do that, I mean, these guys have not shown that kind of Keith and Seabrook, dependability in terms of just physically. So, do you have to be careful with a Kunitz, with a Dupuy, with a Letang, with a Mata early in the season so that they don't get worn down to the point where they're not useful to you down the stretch? That's a really good point, and it's a really good question, and it's something that Jim Rutherford definitely has to take into consideration when he's deciding who really is expendable as he looks to improve that decor a little bit.
Jason, do you think they're seriously considering a trade? And you know, like Rob Rossi, our trip columnist, thinks this defense is going to be epically bad. You know, 5 goals per game bad. Fleury's going to be back to be getting, you know, torched and criticized unfairly. Do they need to go out and get a Dustin Byfuglien or some other of the names that you've heard out there as possible?
Kenny, I'm shocked, stunned that Rossi thinks something is going to be bad. Really? I don't even know how to answer that now. I don't think it's going to be cataclysmically bad. I don't think... You know, is this team going to be, is its strength going to be its goals against? No. It's an offensive team. But are they going to be giving up 7 a night? No, I don't think so. I think, you know, you have to spend your money in certain areas, and this team is spending more money this season on defense than in the past. They've got some young guys and some uncertainty there. And I think to a degree you need to consider some of these guys have not played with their regular defense partners. And in some ways, they don't know who their regular defense partners are. If you split up Mata and Letang, you really got a mishmash back there of what you're going to do. I mean, you know you have Ian Cole, but other than that, you know, do you have Dumoulin and Cole? I'm not sure. Do you have Scuderi and Lovejoy? I'm not sure. Where does that Adam Clendenning fit? Is Gonchar going to make the team? You know, there's all kinds of uncertainty back there, and to make an assessment that this team's going to be bad on defense based on the fact that you've had a revolving door of who you're playing with, I think it's, you know, jumping the shark or some sort of cliche like that. I think it's just a little bit premature. I do think there is room to add a defenseman. You talked about a trade, and, you know, if something was out there, I'm sure they would do it. You know, from sort of investigating it on my end, I get the sense that it's not something that is even possible to do right now. You're either going to pay through the nose or there's nobody available. You know, teams want to sort of keep things close to the vest and see what they have and see what kind of deal they can make. And I mean, it wouldn't even be in the Penguins' interest right now to make a trade. You're playing David Perron on the fourth line, and now you're going to shop him? I mean, teams are looking at that. That's, you know, it's like putting something on the sale rack and then trying to jack the price. It just doesn't make any sense. So if they can get some production out of Perron and get him going, then, yeah, maybe you pulled the trigger, but now is not it.
Well, that's interesting. And, JB, like, they were pumping up Perron, at least the Penguins seemed to be, early in camp here, weren't they, about, like, he's in the best shape of his life, he worked out, he's healthy.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true. If you were going to showcase a guy, then you'd have him in that Crosby and Kessel left wing spot. I mean, geez, think about that. Those guys, first of all, seem to have great chemistry, play well together, so good in open ice. Imagine the numbers. If you just put a guy with them for a month, any guy, imagine what you could theoretically do to his trade value in that month. I mean, you could really pump it up. And the fact that they're not doing that with David Perron makes me think that they're not like running out to get rid of the guy. And I don't, Jason didn't, I mean, nothing he said indicated that they were, you know, desperately trying to unload him, just that it's an area where they could go ahead and get a defenseman. But I think you're right, Ken. I mean, if you wanted to move those guys, you'd showcase them and say, hey, everybody, look at how great our wingers are. Do you want one?
So, right.
Yeah. And a point here, too, kind of left out of the earlier thing, he's in a contract year.
Yeah.
Whether or not they can fit him under the cap next season, I'm not sure. They would have to get creative, and a lot of stuff can happen between now and then, but I think that's part of the impetus for his name coming up here, is that he's in a contract year, and they're unsure on whether they're going to re-sign him.
Well, who are your starting six defensemen if the season were to begin tonight, guys? Jason, you're there, and as you point out, they've split up Mata and Letang, but how about where the rest of the pecking order lies in?
Well, if I was filling out an opening night lineup right now, I would put Mata and Letang together. I think they're, as long as they're healthy, they're good enough to throw out there as much as they can possibly handle it. My second pairing would be Brian Dumoulin and Ian Cole. I think Brian Dumoulin needs a chance. I think you need to see what you have there. And my third pairing would be Ben Lovejoy and Rob Scuderi. And I know that's not a popular choice among certain people, but that's how I would start the season. And I would also be shopping for a top four defenseman. I think they badly need one, and I think that would slot in very well. If you would get a top four guy, you can play him with Ian Cole. If Brian Dumoulin plays well enough, he can bump down to your third pair. And either that, you know, in that trade, maybe you package Scuderi's contract, maybe you package Lovejoy, I'm not sure. Maybe you sit one of the two. But I think it just gives you more depth down the line. But those are the six that I'd start with. JB?
The only difference I have, it's surprising. I agree completely. Mata and Letang should play together. That's an awesome pair. I think there's been chemistry with Dumoulin and Cole, and I've talked to Dumoulin about it, and he loves playing with Ian Cole. I mean, he's practically begging to play with Ian Cole. So, fine. Let him. But the difference, and Scuderi to me is deserves, you know, when I was saying before about if you take the names off the jerseys, who are your top six defensemen so far in the preseason? Rob Scuderi's one of them. You know, people get upset about that because I understand he's, you know, what, 36 and has a high cap hit and all that thing. But I said, let's, you know, disregard all that stuff. He's actually performed pretty well. Certainly, you know, more so than Gonchar or Pouliot or maybe even Lovejoy. I actually, that's my one disagreement with the six you had there, Jason, is I would play Clendenning over Lovejoy to start the season right now. Mm-hmm. I think Lovejoy still has... Lovejoy's still a good player, but he, you know, he hit a wall or hit a slump or something after that trade last year. He did not fit in. And to me, he would have to prove to me that he's out of that, that he's, you know, broken out of that funk before I'd really pencil him in there every single day. You know, I mean, obviously that you're not saying, you know, these are the six that are going to be forever. But just to start, I would play Scuderi and Clendenning on that third pair, just based on merit.
I like Lovejoy. I can follow the logic, absolutely. I think one thing that's interesting between you and IJB is we left Pouliot out of both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's just in his own zone, especially five-on-five situations. He's just been not good in preseason games. Now, they're just preseason games. I understand that. But for a guy like that who's 21 years old, you know, you expect to see a little more. If there was a veteran guy, like if Chris Letang decided to just kind of, you know, take the preseason off, you could live with that and you could understand it and it wouldn't even bother you. But a guy like Pouliot still has something to prove, and then he didn't prove it. And the fact that he does not have to clear waivers, you know, I mean, that looms large. And he had to prove that he was one of the six best, and I don't think he did that. Now, keep in mind, I'm not burying the kid. I'm not saying give up on him, get rid of him, trade him, or anything like that. I think he's got a ton of talent. I think he fits into Johnston's system. Well, obviously he does, because he did in Portland for a number of years. But I think right now, you got to go with your best six or seven, and just based on exhibition games, he hasn't been one of them.
How bad, Jason, have Pouliot and Gonchar been? Are they as bad as their goals allowed in the preseason with them on the ice would indicate?
Yes. Yes, they would.
Yeah.
And yeah, I thought it was interesting that, you know, Gonchar made the trip, but he's not going to play tonight. And same thing with Pouliot. And Mike Johnston basically said, you know, wasn't quite a direct answer, but said, we've seen, you know, what we need to see, and they've played their games. If that's the case, that's not good. Were I Sergei Gonchar, or were I evaluating Sergei Gonchar, I would really want to see one more game. And I realize in all the, you know, 4,000 games he's played in the NHL, not really hyperbole, but you know what type of player he is. That being said, I would still just want one more game, maybe to feel better about picking up his contract or signing him to a contract after what I've seen in the preseason. It's just really problematic. Either that, or they know what direction they're going to go. They know that Pouliot can start the season at Wilkes-Barre, and they know that Gonchar is not capable of playing in this lineup. I'm not sure. I'm not sure which one it is. My gut tells me that they're going to keep Gonchar around here and that it would ruffle too many feathers for him to leave, but we'll find out over the weekend, I guess.
So he would be the eighth defenseman that just is inactive every game night? Is that the suspicion?
Yeah,
or
basically he'd practice a lot, and then you'd maybe play him in back-to-back situations, you know, give Rob Scuderi a night off. And you know this blue line, Kenny. I mean, somebody's going to get hurt. Probably five people are going to get hurt. You know, they've shown no ability to stay healthy. So I don't know. Having that many players around would help, and I do think there's interest from the Penguins to get Gonchar to sort of transition into a management, general management, coaching, some sort of role. You know, they might even have to make something up. But, you know, I know they don't want Gonchar to just walk away and go sign with another team. I mean, he might do that if they don't pick up his PTO, depending on how much he wants to play. But, I mean, they like him a lot. They would value having him around the team. I'm just not sure it's as a player.
I think given Gonchar's, what we've seen out of him five-on-five in his own zone, I think in order to play him, you have to play 7D that night. I think it's it's almost a necessity. Just because if you just put him out there on a regular shift, especially on the road where teams get the last change, they're just going to attack him. So, you know, at home in a 7D role where you can spot him on the power play, man, he still has it on the power play. I mean, he still has that vision and the sort of just a calm that other defensemen don't have. But spotting him in that role without getting him in a spot where he's going to be, you know, taken advantage of, it's really a test of coaching and being able to, you know, take advantage of your matchups. And that's, you know, maybe Mike Johnston wants to take on that challenge. I don't know. But it wouldn't be easy. Let's put it that way.
And they'd have to just have a guy double shift right on the fourth line or whatever if you dress 7D.
Sure.
Who would handle that role? Could Malkin or Crosby just double shift and...
Well,
play extra minutes?
There is a school of thought that the more, you know, you add a couple minutes for Crosby, a couple minutes for Malkin, and then, you know, another one of, say, Bonino, Those are three of your better forwards. There's no harm in getting them a couple of extra shifts as long as they can, you know, as long as it doesn't lead to physical wear and tear on them. You know, more. And would you rather have, you know, a Crosby or Malkin take an extra shift, or, you know, a fourth line center out on the ice? You know, in terms of goal production, you'd obviously want the Crosby and Malkin as long as they can physically handle it. Yeah, I mean, it can be done. It's not Tampa did it most of the playoffs last year, and it worked out really well for them. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a little bit unusual, but there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, especially for, you know, like you're saying, just like, say, the back end of a back-to-back situation. So you go with 11 forwards, get Gonchar in there to help out your power play. Say you have a stretch where the power play has been struggling, maybe you bring him in there for a boost. To me, it's like a spot kind of role. It can be done. I don't know if you'd want to do it every game, but it can be done.
Interesting. All right, well, we'll talk more about the power play coming up. Jason saw the look this morning, the umbrella look down in Raleigh at PNC Arena, where he's going to be on hand for the Penguins' final preseason game tonight. Talk about Rick Tocchet speaking to you guys a few days ago, some of the comments he made, maybe some upset at a little bit of the fourth liners who didn't show up in preseason, and also our first big controversy of the season, no Crosby in Johnstown. It got the Penguins organization Jagoff of the Week awards on our show on Wednesday, so we'll get the take from Jason and Jonathan, who was there on the scene, whether they deserved it or not. The Pens Roundtable continues every Friday now from 1 until 2. Ken Laird with Pittsburgh Penguins writers Jason Mackey and Jonathan Bomboli here on Trib Live Radio.
Before every Steelers game, don't miss the Mike and Dave's Black and Gold pregame show, the best and most comprehensive Pittsburgh pregame show, taking you right up to kickoff.
We're going to be here all day, baby. I like this kind of party.
All the Steelers insiders from the Trib and exclusive Steeler player interviews, plus live reports from the stadiums, all right here on Trib Live Radio. The Mike and Dave's Black and Gold pregame show is brought to you by Mike and Dave's Italian Bread Place, Deli and Catering in Greentree, and Mike and Dave's Boardwalk Sandwich Shop in Brentwood on Sawmill Run Boulevard, right across from Getco. Go online to theitalianbreadplace.com and watch the Super Sub being made.
The home of the Super Sub, Mike and Dave's Italian Bread Place, Deli and Catering in Greentree. Call 412-922-2970 and Mike and Dave's Boardwalk Sandwich Shop in Brentwood on Sawmill Run Boulevard, right across from Getco. Call 412-885-1155. Brentwood location is not open on Sundays. Heading to the game? Call ahead at 412-922-2970 and then stop by Mike and Dave's Italian Bread Place, Deli and Catering in Greentree to pick up the Super Sub, plus the sandwich ring, sides, salads, desserts, and everything you need for the perfect tailgate and viewing party. The Super Sub Saturday and Sunday special is only $16.95, regularly $19.95, and includes your choice of a large side, which feeds up to three people at no additional cost. Go right now to theitalianbreadplace.com to watch the Super Sub being made. Theitalianbreadplace.com. Trib Live Radio presents the Penguins Roundtable Show, featuring Trib hockey writers Jason Mackey and Jonathan Bomboli.
Wake up, superstar!
Hosted by Ken Laird.
Want to go, pretty boy? Come on.
The best hockey talk in Pittsburgh, right now on Trib Live Radio.
We're going to play some friggin' old-time hockey!
Jonathan Bomboli stood in for Ogie Oglethorpe Wednesday in War Memorial Johnstown. That was a nice touch, Jonathan. Since Ogie couldn't make it, the real Ogie down from Canada, good on you for stepping in there.
Yeah, I understand that he's worried about his immigration status. the law enforcement might not let him in this country or back into Canada if he came down. That was so much fun, I got to tell you. You know, we in the sports writing business, we tend to be cynical about things. I couldn't muster up any cynicism that night. It was just fun. It was like the people were happy to have the event there, and the you know, lots of, you know, Hanson brothers and lots of Slapshot nostalgia. And I went and saw, you know, lots of Slapshot sort of landmarks and things. And I got to tell you, it was just, there was nothing bad about it except that it rained all day. That's about it. Everything else was just, you know, a lot of fun.
Well, if, for everybody who watched the NBC Sports Network, there was some cynicism coming from Mike Gilbert, as there always is. Of course, Crosby's lack of presence was a topic. Did you sense that being out there, that people missed him or were asking where he was?
Yeah, I think there were, I mean, there was, it was more sort of, once the game got started, you know, I think people were sort of into it. But I think during the pregame kind of festivities, I think people were a little, I don't know if upset is the right word, disappointed. Probably is the way to look at it. I mean, I'm having a hard time. I know this is like, I'll lose my talk radio card for saying this, but I don't really have a hot take on this either way. Like, I can see it both ways, you know. I mean, I can see where the Penguins want to say, look, we got a season to get ready for. We appreciate your awesome event, but we have to play our players in the games where we think it makes the most sense to get them physically ready for the opener. And I can also see the other side of it where you say, look, just bring the guy out, you know. It's good for the league. It's good for the game. It's good for the people of Johnstown. So, I mean, I can see both sides of it. I don't know. Ken, Jason, anybody, somebody have a strong feeling on this to make up for my wishy-washiness?
Yeah, I thought they dropped the ball. I'll take the Crosby camp opinion. I'll defend the Penguins on this. I think it's ridiculous. And how much does he have to talk and do? You know, if it was that important, don't schedule three games in three nights. My goodness, the guy talks at every turn. He's at every function, every media thing, media tour. Talk about this, talk about that. And he does it all. And he's smiling and does all of his obligations. And everybody says, oh, you're going to do it to better the league. How about he's almost 30 years old? How about some other people chip in? Which, you know, they kind of did. And how much can you really complain about getting to see Evgeny Malkin, Patrick Hornquist, Steven Stamkos? It's not exactly like the Penguins brought their team from Wheeling. And that's nothing against the poor guys from Wheeling. There were legitimate players there. And I get that it could have made sense, but the Penguins aren't in operation, and Sidney Crosby isn't in the preseason to make everybody happy about the, you know, pushing further or growing the sport or gaining interest or whatever the other excuses are for him having to go to these events. So, yeah, I wasn't that put off by it. I think Mike Milbury, you know, can probably worry about other things, and I bet you, you know, Mike Johnston, Jim Rutherford, anybody who had anything to do with this decision probably laughed hysterically at getting criticized by it. They need to win hockey games. They need to figure out how to do that, and they don't need to figure out how to parade Crosby around a farcical event that is basically just a corporate sponsorship. I get it was cool. It looked awesome on TV, but that's all this is.
What was the reaction in Quebec, Jason? Were they equally upset he wasn't there for the Quebec City game?
No. No, but to be fair, I wouldn't have known if they were mad.
Okay.
My French ain't that good.
Okay, fair enough.
I will say this. I think Malkin really got into the spirit of it. Like, you know, I mean, he comes out for warm-ups wearing the Hanson Brothers glasses, his line, you know, with Plotnikov and Hornquist. And then once the game started, Malkin has that sort of sense of the dramatic, that kind of showmanship. He went out there and played just an incredible game. I mean, that line completely took the game over.
I want to ask you about that. I mean, Plotnikov, is that a... sounded like from Rick Tocchet they have pairs, not lines, that they're set in stone. And Hornquist and Malkin are the set-in-stone pairing. But Plotnikov's been a success there so far, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? They'll say that. I wanted to mention that these coaches, assistants and, you know, Agnew and Tocchet and Johnston, they'll all say, every chance they get, they'll say, we're kind of going with pairs. We're going to rotate the other wings. So we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, Kunitz with Crosby and Plotnikov with Malkin and whoever with whoever. Unless they're just sort of paying lip service to that, there's going to be some rotation there. But getting back to your original point, Plotnikov has been, I would say he's been probably better than I expected. Like, I thought he was going to sort of be a bottom six guy with a little bit of offensive upside, because just judging by the highlights I'd seen from him and people who I've talked to have seen him play, he seemed like a real direct, straightforward kind of player, physical. And he is that. But he also is pretty good around the net and has some pretty good hands and seems to mesh well with skilled players like Malkin and Hornquist. So I think he actually has like a better chance to stick permanently with those two guys than Kunitz does with Crosby and Kessel. I think there will be some rotating with Crosby and Kessel. I think Plotnikov may be playing his way out of the rotation and into a regular spot, you know, at least for maybe a few weeks at a time, you know, or a month or what have you. I'm not saying for the whole 6 month grind, but for, you know, more than just a game or two.
What do you think, Jay? What's Plotnikov's impact been so far, and is he a sticker there on line two?
For now, I mean, you've certainly seen nothing out of him that you would want to move him. I think the Penguins coaches, like JB said, are kind of talking out of both sides of their mouth. They want to find chemistry, but they want to have pairs. Well, to me, chemistry, and you know what your pairs are, theoretically. I mean, chemistry to me means finding a three-man unit that works well together. And I think that's exactly what you found in Malkin, Hornquist, and Plotnikov. Honestly, I didn't expect it to work that well together. You have two kind of physical net front guys, and, you know, there's always been this sort of stigma attached to Malkin that he needs a shooter on his line, like a James Neal. And I know me personally, I expect Kessel to be there, or even David Perron, and that's just not been the case. So if those guys as a three-man unit work that well together, then that's a line. I don't care about your pairs. Throw your pairs out the window. You know, that's a good line. And if Kunitz keeps playing the way he does, that's a line. I don't care about your pairs. Now, maybe that's what they do on the bottom six. I'm not sure. But as far as Plotnikov's game, I mean, I've really liked it. I like his ability and his willingness to go into the corners. He just does not seem affected by the KHL to NHL transition whatsoever. And I don't know, maybe the speed of the game will change in the regular season, and maybe the decision making, maybe that will be a hang up for him. I'm not sure. I don't get the sense that's going to be the case. He seems like a really bright kid. He seems like a really he understands hockey well. The English is kind of coming, but he certainly seems comfortable there on the ice. So I mean you got to play him. That's been your best line, you know, three person unit in the preseason.
I wonder, I mean, between Plotnikov and Bonino, these are kind of unknown players, and they'll add, you know, Fair in a bit, you know, however long he's out and rejoins the team. But could all three be 20-goal scorers, or at least one of the three, any of the three, John? I mean, besides, that Crosby and Malkin are counted on for that, and Kessel, of course, now, and Hornquist. But it could be six 20-goal scorers on this team if things go well.
I think that's probably the way it's drawn up, you know. Plotnikov, to me... I would think that he probably does pencil in as that kind of 20-goal scorer, but I'm really, as we're speaking, I'm feeling to myself like, hey, slow down a little bit on this kid. Just because we've seen guys have really good preseasons. Well, I mean, use the NFL as an example. Think of all the preseason stars over the years who, once the real bullets are flying, they don't look so hot. So... from what I've seen from Plotnikov, yeah, I'd expect him to hit 20 goals, absolutely. But I'm going to reserve the right to, you know, 2 weeks from now, say, hey, we were a little bit hasty on this one. I need more sample size.
Who disappointed in camp, Jason, if anybody? Like Rick Tocchet was saying, he was asked about, I think Mark Madden asked the question, you know, who didn't step up on the bottom lines, and Tocchet sort of agreed, didn't give any names, but... would it be obvious that it's like Sundqvist and Sheary and Scott Wilson and some of these players that got cut?
Yeah, I would say the fact that I would say the whole group of them. The fact that none of these guys who actually saw NHL games last year did anything to take control of that job. You know, the fact that we're even having a discussion as to who's going to win this, you know, derby, so to speak. And, you know, I'm not saying anything to criticize Daniel Sprong, because I think he's done something in his own right. He's probably stepped up and grabbed this position more than anybody else. But Brian Rust, Scott Wilson, Connor Sheary, Oscar Sundqvist, these guys either played NHL games in the regular season, or in Sundqvist's case, the preseason, and played them really well. I really expected maybe a Scott Wilson to step up and take control of that job and prove that he is supposed to be here. He looked really good in the playoffs last year. I thought he was one of their best and most consistent forwards, but that was just, they looked really, really bad. And I would say the other two disappointments we already talked about, Derek Pouliot and Sergei Gonchar. Right. I didn't expect Gonchar to come in here and be like, you know, Norris Trophy level good, but I expected him to be maybe serviceable 5-on-5 to the point where you could put him out there and not be worried about a team just throwing its best five offensive players on the ice and assuming they'd score. And Derek Pouliot kind of being, I don't want to say aloof, but just, if I played that way defensively, or if other people played that way defensively, wouldn't you get a little fiery or a little testy? Or if a reporter's asking the question, bite his head off. You know, I kind of half expected going up to Pouliot after the Columbus game to, you know, have him lay into me. It would have been reasonable. But, you know, he's just kind of ho-humming along, and he might be playing his way out of an NHL team. So, I don't know. Those would be my three picks.
How about you, Jonathan? And, you know, last year I remember you and I talking at playoff time. You had seen Scott Wilson a lot, and Kasperi Kapanen a bit too, and they went for Wilson in the postseason, which was a bit of a surprise to both of us. But they liked him enough then, but obviously now he's a quick cut and he's back to the AHL.
You know what? I think the reason he got cut is the reason. I mean, it's still in line with what we were talking about last year with Kapanen. I mean, I thought Kapanen was the better choice at that point because he was more of a dynamic player, he was more of a difference maker. And what you'd get out of Wilson is just sort of solid two-way play, won't hurt you, won't help you that much. Well, Wilson in training camp, and some other guys fit this mold too, you know, Sundquist and Russ to a certain extent, that's how they played in these exhibition games. They played perfectly fine, quiet games. Didn't cause any problems in the defensive zone, didn't really make any plays in the offensive zone. Well, if you're a call-up who's trying to, you know, be a stopgap while somebody's hurt for 2 weeks, that's a perfectly fine way to play. But if you're in training camp and you're trying to stand out, that's the bottom line. You try to stand out, and Daniel Sprung stood out big time. Bobby Farnham, he played one game, and he playing his particular style of play, went face first into the boards because that's sort of what he does.
That stood out, yeah.
Yeah, he stood out in that sense, and if he plays tonight, he'll stand out again because he doesn't know any other way to play. He doesn't have quiet games. So, but these other guys did, and when you're trying to win a job quiet and safe and, you know, somewhat effective, it's just not the way to go. It's not going to get you a job. Back in the old days, you'd try to win that job by running somebody through the boards or fighting somebody or doing something ridiculous. They don't do that anymore, so it kind of limits the options that a young player has to make sure the coach notices them. I remember talking to Phil Bork about that, is that his first few camps, he would just say to himself, I have to make sure the coach notices me today, whatever it takes. So sometimes that meant fighting somebody, and sometimes that meant, you know, whatever, going the extra mile on the back check, but just make sure the coach notices me. And I don't know that a lot of these candidates for that forward spot, I don't think they really took that approach. They just took a kind of like a safe approach, and safe as death, as John Tortorella used to like to say.
Well, yeah, and Jason, like, there are still teams that employ guys that are going to be coming after Crosby, Kessel, and the like. I mean, Zach Rinaldo's signed by the Bruins for a reason. I mean, when they play the Bruins, he's coming after their stars. Do they have enough of the grit and guys that will stand out in that way on the bottom? Is that why Farnham's probably going to make the team?
Well, I'm not sure if I want Bobby Farnham fighting Zach Rinaldo. It's not going to end well.
I don't know about a fight, but maybe you want him going after Patrice Bergeron in retaliation, you know, or the threat of it. At least that's the old way.
Yeah, I mean, I like the element Farnham brings. I know that he's like a 50-50 split. You know, 50% of the fans are going to hate you for saying you like Farnham. 50% are going to say it's great. But I like what he brings. I would value that and keep him on the fourth line. I think he's entertaining. I think he does things like you're talking about, the threat of going after another player and getting a team that is predicated on scoring on the power play to the power play. I think that's really important. So for that reason alone, yeah, I'd keep Farnham. But I also have some questions on whether they have enough deterrence there. I really would feel better if this team had one guy who was capable of handling himself in such situations. And maybe that's Tom Sestito, who today agreed to a PTO in Wilkes-Barre. I don't know. But in games where they play somebody like Zach Rinaldo, I would like to have somebody like Tom Sestito in there just to know that it can be taken care of. If you don't have anybody like that, and let's say Bobby Farnham's not in the lineup, you can say the threat is your power play, which has kind of been Jim Rutherford's, you know, line all offseason. I get that, but I mean, it only takes one time. It only takes one hit, and you know, if something would happen to Sidney Crosby, I don't know. JB, I think I've heard you use this line before. It's like insurance. You know, you don't want to use it, but you're glad you have it if you need it. And they're playing a team like that with somebody like a Zach Rinaldo. You know, I just want somebody else in there.
You know, my problem with the way the Penguins would respond to, say, some kind of, you know, somebody taking liberties is it's not on moral grounds. Like, I'm not opposed to a guy like Tom Sestito grabbing somebody who hit Crosby and punching him in the face. I think that's great. I'm opposed to it on these grounds. The Penguins aren't any good at it. They aren't any good at handling these types of situations. When you look at that Columbus, it's just an exhibition game. No big deal. But Olimata gets knocked down by Brett Gallant after a whistle. Not a violent hit, but definitely kind of a Bush League move. It's on a delayed offside call. He knocks over your best defenseman. That's not cool. So eventually Steve Alexie fights him. fights Gallant, and it should end there, and they should go back to the game and play hockey. But in this Penguins situation, and this seems to have happened over the years with the different cast of characters, I don't know why it is, but on the ensuing faceoff, Sestito starts punching Brandon Dubinsky, and then it becomes a power play situation. And then in the four-on-four situation, the Penguins are running all over the place, still rattled from this deal, give up a goal. Then on the three-minute power play that follows, they give up two goals, and all of a sudden they're losing 4-0. And so they just need – the reason they need to focus on making opponents pay with the power play rather than with a punch is because that's how they're constructed. They don't have, you know, it's fine to have a guy like Sestito can come up and handle a situation, and if that's the end of it, and then on the next shift, their guys go back to playing their game, an offensive speed-based style, then great, I'm all in favor of that. But that tends to not be what happens. What happens is then their skill guys start playing like they're, you know, they want to get some kind of physical revenge, and then one thing leads to another, and all hell breaks loose, and you're, all of a sudden you have that Flyers series from a couple of years ago. So right. to me, their best bet is to just don't play that game. Just don't do it. Look, you know, turn the other cheek. If you have to take a punch to get a power play, take a punch to get a power play. Not because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the right thing for your particular lineup to do.
To me, though, I think this lineup is hard to speak to logically. And what I mean by that is the end of the, I think it was the Detroit game the other night. You have Pascal Dupuis, Chris Letang, and Sidney Crosby involved in, like, pseudo fights.
Yeah.
If you could handpick three people you don't want involved in pseudo fights, it would be those three.
Concussion history, a stroke, and a blood disorder, and they're all fighting Tyler Bertuzzi at the end of the game. Yeah, I know. It's bizarre.
I don't care if they flip out and they're not able to handle themselves or not. Like, those three should be able to just skate away and somebody let Tom Sestito out of his cage and go do what he's paid to do, you know, in situations like that. I mean, you should just skate away anyway if you're those three, but I mean, I get that that stuff needs handled. And to me, I wouldn't stop the process as much as I would try to work within it and improve how they handle it.
Yeah,
if
okay.
that's possible.
Let's put it this way, compartmentalize better. Like, let the skill players do their skill things, let the tough guys handle the tough guy things, and don't mix the two. That I could go
yeah.
for.
Like, yeah. get to the bench and get some popcorn and just watch.
Yep.
And just have a good time if you're Sidney Crosby. Like, I want you playing with no negative emotions. You will never fight anybody. If you throw a punch, you're suspended. You know, something just make a ridiculous rule. I don't know. You have to do something to get through to these guys that, like, 9/58/87. You don't fight people. That's not your in your job description. You're not even allowed to do that.
Well, last year the power play was 10th, I believe, in the league. It's not bad. It feels like it was worse. Should be better. How good's the power play looking so far, Jason, when you watch it? And, you know, that gets into the Gonchar factor maybe, but if he's not on the ice, who will be the five?
You know what? That unit, both units, they were unstoppable this morning. They were going 5-on-0. They literally scored every time. No, I'm kidding.
I
like the look of the power play. I don't know what they're going to do as far as one unit or two units. They broke them into two units today, and it was basically Malkin's line and Sid's line, and then you throw a couple extras. You know, Mata Perron went on with Sid, and then Sprong and Letang went on with Malkin's line. They might combine them, and you might see an 87-81-58, the top unit. Hornquist is on there and whatever. I don't know what the right move is, but I like what they're doing in the slot and what like Crosby's role, basically reading and reacting and being able to be a bit of a rover, work behind the net some, use his smarts. I feel like that's something they didn't do well enough. They tried to kind of balance out Crosby and Malkin and run it down the middle, and I think you never really saw, you know, once things fell off, that middle guy doing what he should be doing. And so I like using Crosby there. I think that'll be interesting to see how that develops over the course of the season. But they definitely, boy, if they start hot again, you just kind of wait for, like, the other shoe to drop. You know, it was so weird last season how great they were early, and then it just turned off.
Don't you think Kessel on the left half wall changes that, though?
Makes it less
likely that there's going to be that drop off. He's so dangerous over there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's it. I think that's the one constant, right, JB? You can just, you know that you're going to have Kessel there. You know that you're going to have a dangerous player on that left side. It's beautiful.
And it really opens things up. And like you were saying about Crosby in that Rover role, if you load up that first power play and you put Kessel on one half wall, Malkin on the other, defenses have to take that cross ice pass away first. They have to. Because if that gets through, it's a goal every time. And that gives Crosby a lot of, if he knows what the defense has to do, he can exploit that. So to me, on paper, having those three guys on the ice together on the power play should be really, really effective.